Mr. R was the first radio operator to become a channel between the small planet we call home and the vastness of interstellar space. He became a bridge for men of goodwill throughout the Father's limitless realm. Now his key is silent, for he has graduated to another dimension of time and space. He is now free of the restrictions of Earth, free to communicate forever with worlds without number. We say, goodbye, for just a little while, Mr. R. Light. Love. Peace. As you travel the great path up to the stars. After the highly successful radio experiments of 1952-53, our group decided to write a book on our experiences. We realized that the information we had received was of the greatest importance to all mankind. We asked Mr. R. if he cared to write a book about his radio contacts with outer space, but he said that he was not interested in making his experiments known publicly, but he did not object if others wrote about them. At that time we had him sign an affidavit, subscribed and sworn to before Genevieve D. Scott, Notary Public, Winslow, Arizona, on the 7th day of March 1953. While he was willing to sign the affidavit, he also told us that he didn't want his name or call letters, since he was a licensed ham radio operator, used in any way whatsoever. This was a great disappointment to us, because we felt that without such information any book on the results of the experiments would fall far short of that which we desired for it. The book would lack the authority that we wanted and needed. However, he was a good friend and we told him we would never disclose his name. We are doing so now in this edition since Mr. R. passed away on the 23rd of April 1955, with what was said to be a heart condition and other contributing factors. The frontispiece of this book contains the original affidavit revealing the names of Mr. R., licensed commercial and amateur radio operator, and his wife, Mrs. R., plus the name of the Arizona city in which they made their home. Mr. R. was Lyman H. Streeter, radio operator for the Santa Fe Railroad. His amateur call letters were W70JQ. He lived at 423 East Maple Street in Winslow, Arizona. Lyman had good reasons for not wanting his identity known. First of all, he had never used his call letters during his communication with the space intelligences and he never logged any of his receptions. If these facts were made known, he knew he would lose his license, and this was the very last thing he wanted, for to him radio was his very life. Also, he knew that even if he had complied fully with the regulations of the Federal Communications Commission, his license would still be taken away, for no operator is permitted to make contact with an unlicensed operator and the UFOs aren't licensed with the FCC. Lyman Streeter's first contact with intelligence from outer space took place the evening of the 22nd of August 1952. He was a good radio operator holding both a commercial and a ham or amateur license. Lyman was very skeptical of the existence of flying saucers, let alone the possibility of communicating with such objects by radio. However, he was willing to attempt contact. Friday evening, the 22nd of August 1952, Lyman saw what he thought was a very small meteor display over Winslow. Then he observed what appeared to be a very bright light traveling at a high altitude in the sky directly above him. He turned on his receiver in his ham shack to 400 kc, and immediately, many strange signals were heard but not identified. Later on, the same evening, the Streeters and other witnesses heard strange, clear code signals coming to them as they sat in the main house. Lyman had his ham shack on the back of their property, and he had no transmitting or receiving equipment whatsoever in the main house. At first, everyone thought the signals were coming from the radio shack in the backyard, but when they went to check, there was absolutely nothing to be heard there. In fact, the equipment wasn't even turned on. After they came back to the main house, the mysterious code was heard again. It seemed to be coming from the very air itself. Since that memorable evening in 1952, many others have reported experiencing exactly the same thing and said it sounded as though two people were talking back and forth to each other, using code. But a code unfamiliar to him. It was definitely not standard international Morse code. The code was coming over his receiver in loud, clear tones. Suddenly, he wrote down a word or two on his notepad, so and affa. Later we learned that a superior of Lyman Streeter's in the radio work of the Santa Fe Railroad, a man high up in radio circles, had told him that he also had received strange signals at various times during his radio experiments and that he definitely believed such signals to be from space intelligences. However, he had been evasive when Lyman asked for further information and had seemed to want to discourage him in his own experiments. Why? One day, this superior called Lyman and told him that Lowell Observatory on Mars Hill, in Flagstaff, Arizona had observed UFOs on Friday the 22nd of August 1952. Exactly the same day that Streeter received his first radio signals from space intelligences. This superior also said that a staff member at Lowell Observatory had reported to him earlier that on the 22nd of August 1952, they would focus their largest telescope for terrestrial observation over Winslow. But the man had not said what they were going to look for or why. Also, no mention had been made of the source of the information that caused this observation to be made in the first place. Hill overlooking Flagstaff, where he was making a survey for the Santa Fe Railroad in connection with new radio equipment being installed on the top of Mount Elgin. In an area away from the big observatory, he saw a strange small building surrounded by a high wire fence. Inside the enclosed area he saw two gigantic dogs, obviously watchdogs. Navy men were moving various types of electronic equipment in and out of the little building, which looked new and recently painted. He wondered what such equipment was doing on Mars Hill. He was informed that if the new equipment belonging to the railroad being installed on Mount Elgin interfered with the government work on Mars Hill, then it would have to be placed elsewhere. Several years later we learned that the government had placed electronic equipment at Lowell Observatory to assist in the tracking of two artificial satellites or space stations that were known to be circling the Earth at 400 and 600 miles out in space. In August 1954, the magazine New Aviation Weeker reported that the two objects were meteors, and insisted that Dr. Lincoln Lapas of the University of New Mexico had helped in the identification of them as unnatural rather than man-made objects. Dr. Lapas attacked the magazine's reference to him, but acknowledged the search for nearby satellites. He also said, "The report is false in every particular insofar as reference to me is concerned." Dr. Lapas and Dr. Clyde Tombaugh, discoverer of the planet Pluto, both worked on the government project at Lowell Observatory, and both of these men are fully aware that the objects tracked by electronic equipment are not natural, and because of their actions in the heavens could only be artificial, constructed by other intelligent beings. When Sir Edward Appleton, famous British radio physicist, said these two unknown objects are discoveries of great astronomical interest, he didn't know the half of it. Or did he? It is very likely that Sir Edward knew what Lapas and Tombaugh knew, and the same thing that the United States government knew when it had the Navy set up an experimental station on Mars Hill. Lyman Streeter stumbled into that secret project in 1952 when he was at Lowell Observatory. Other messages were received, over a period of several months, by Lyman Streeter in his ham shack at the back of the lot at 423 East Maple Street. He had been very skeptical at first. However, after he saw disks in the sky where his radio messages told him to look, disks over his own radio antenna, and after messages were received telling about things which no one but he could have known, and finally, messages coming over the receiver that were answers to questions that had never been transmitted to the intelligences in the usual manner, Streeter's attitude changed. They had either picked up verbal statements made in the ham shack by telepathy and/or by some kind of recording discs. Soon, our Mr. R had his proof. I remember his facial expression on many occasions, he appeared just too bewildered to even think. Lyman usually transmitted on 40 meters and received on 405 kc. On one occasion he received via radio telephone, voice, on 92 meters. However, we are certain that frequency has nothing whatsoever to do with it. Space intelligences have stated many times that they can make anything act as a receiver from radio equipment to the human brain. At first, Streeter told us that he never had had any interest in UFOs before we contacted him to attempt communication with them. However, upon questioning, he later admitted that he had become very much interested in the possibility of interstellar communication in 1950 after he read an article on this subject in QST, one of the amateur ham radio magazines. He said that he had attempted some sort of contact at that time on a high frequency and a short wavelength. However, the experiment was a failure and he gave it up. There was always something strange overshadowing the life of Mr. R that I find impossible to describe in words. The only clue I might have would be a radio message from the UFOs we received during the evening of the 28th of September 1952. At 11:20 p.m. the following message came through the receiver: "Radioman has deep secret in his mind. We will not reveal, we are alarmed." Streeter turned to the rest of us in the ham shack and said, "If they, the UFOs, had known about this before, they would never have picked me for your radioman." Immediately, code came through the receiver again: "Be of peace." We waited for several minutes without talking until more code started. "Happy, happy. You, radioman Kanita installed in the records. Good. Attention. Surprised, my brother? What was meant by deep secret?" Evidently Lyman and his wife knew, for they looked at each other in a strange way and she came over to sit beside him and hold his hand. Lyman seemed very concerned over this message. None of us was impolite enough to ask the Streeters what it all meant, so we said nothing. Anyway, the space intelligences didn't stay alarmed for long, for they spoke of Streeter being installed in the records and called him by another name, Radioman Kanit. This name was formally left out of the message because we felt it was something that belonged to Streeter alone and could be of no interest to the public. However, it is well to mention it now, for it might be a clue for which we are looking. I remember how, one evening, Streeter told us, rather reluctantly, it seemed, that after attempting contact in 1950 he had appeared one day at work acting in a very strange manner. He went about his assigned radio tasks in the normal way, but his fellow workers noticed he wouldn't answer them when they spoke to him and behaved as if he were in a trance of some kind. His wife was called, and he was taken home. For 8 days he was in this unusual zombie condition. He said nothing to anyone during that period. Later, when he regained a state of normalcy, he admitted he couldn't remember a thing that had transpired during those 8 days of amnesia. After the contacts started on the 22nd of August 1952, Streeter suddenly remembered what had happened several years previously, during the memory lapse. He told us that he apparently had left his earthly body, that would account for the zombie condition. The physical body had gone about its usual tasks at work under the direction of the animal mind, while the entity had been elsewhere, and awoke in a beautiful, large hall where many people were gathering. He was called before a tribunal and noticed that he was dressed in fine garments. He was called by a different name, Kanit, and told that he must work rapidly to complete his task upon the Earth planet. All he could remember from this 8-day journey was the fact that he must work quickly. His wife said that before the period of amnesia Lyman was just an ordinary radioman, but after his recovery he spent long hours studying electronics and would work for hours on end until he became a top-grade operator. Besides working at the Santa Fe radio shop, he had his amateur equipment in his ham shack back of his home on Maple Street, and at the other end of this shack his workshop, where he repaired most of the radios, TV sets, recorders, etc., of the neighborhood, including the car radios of the local police department. I remember that once the police interrupted one of our communications with the UFOs by driving into the yard one night and asking Lyman to fix their radio. He obliged, but kept trying to hear the code coming in, listen to the idle talk of the officers and fix the radio, all at the same time. Evidently, Lyman H. Streeter was a wanderer. His name had been Kanit, and he was born on Earth to assist the program of the Space Confederation. His so-called amnesia experience must have been his awakening period. See page 206 in the book, A Other Tongues Other Flesh, or Neville Spearman, editor on the 21st of October 1952, something occur that was to change the life of Mr. R. At 8:10 p.m. a small private plane crashed and burned at the airport at Winslow. This plane was on a mercy flight to a Phoenix hospital with a 14-month-old polio victim. All four passengers were instantly killed. One of the workers at the Winslow Timber Company, where Mrs. Streeter also was employed, was working late, and saw the plane take off and minutes later burst into flames. This man told the Civil Aeronautics Administration investigators that immediately after the crash, and before the ambulance and fire truck had arrived, an orange streak sped across the sky and apparently landed by the stricken plane. UFOs appearing at the moment of birth or death are mentioned in the book, A Road in the Sky, A by George Hunt Williamson, Neville Spearman, editor. Several days later, a man appeared at the Streeter home and introduced himself as Mr. Clark. He asked Mrs. Streeter for Lyman and was told that he was outside in the radio shack. The man went out and introduced himself to Lyman, saying that although he was not on an official visit, he was with the CAA, Civil Aeronautics Administration, and had just completed his investigations of the crash of 21 October. He showed Lyman his credentials. Then, on a friendlier note, he said, "I'm a ham operator myself." Then he gave his call letters. Streeter later checked up and found that there was a clerk with the call letters the man had given, but his address was not the same as that which had been given him. The visitor then sat down, and said bluntly, "Streeter, what do you think of the flying saucers?" Lyman sensed something strange underneath all the apparent friendliness, but he answered honestly, "I have my own personal opinion, if that's what you mean. I think they come from outer space." And then, very quickly, the man looked Lyman in the eyes and said, "You've had radio contact with these things, haven't you?" Streeter realized that this man, Clark, or whoever he was, knew whether he had had radio communication or not, so he said simply, "I have conducted certain radio experiments under established scientific procedures. Yes, I have had contact with the flying saucers." Whereupon Clark asked, "Would you mind showing me what you received from them? It's no secret, is it?" Streeter reached for his notes in a drawer, as he answered, "No, it's no secret. I'll be glad to read you what I have. But I must tell you that because the messages were sent so fast, I missed many of the words, so the messages are incomplete." Lyman started to read one message after another. Soon he noticed that whenever he came to a blank space, Clark would fill it in. Finally, Streeter said, "Look here, you must know more about the messages I received than I do." "That's right," Clark answered. "A, we monitored everything you transmitted and received." Lyman was startled, to say the least. He said, "What do you mean by we? The government?" Clark hesitated, put his cigarette out, looked intently at Lyman for another moment, and then said, "Of course, who else?" Streeter could hardly believe his ears. Confirmation of his experiments at last. But any ideas along this line were soon to be changed rather drastically. Lyman quickly answered, "You mean to tell me, Mr. Clark, you admit that flying saucers really exist, are coming from outer space, and that I have personally had radio communication with these objects?" Clark didn't hesitate in his answers. "Of course I admit it, but you won't be able to prove it to anyone. You see, no one knows I've been here but you and your wife, and besides, I would never admit we talked about such things. I have been in Winslow strictly for the CAA investigation of the recent plane crash. Remember?" Weakly, Lyman said, "Just what does your visit to me mean?" "This is the story," said Clark. "About the same time you were receiving your coded messages from the extraterrestrials, 15 other ham operators throughout the United States received the same kind of information. We have contacted them all and every one of them is willing to cooperate with his government. Are you?" Lyman, still unable to believe what was happening, answered, "What do you mean by a cooperation, eh, Mr. Clark?" Then, the CAA man pulled his ace in the hole. "Look, Streeter, we have you dead to rights. You never used your call letters, you never logged your information, and even if you had done all of that, we still can take away your license because you were in communication with unlicensed operators. The FCC, Federal Communications Commission, frowns on such activity, you know. Now, you don't want to lose your radio privileges after all. You are commercially licensed besides holding your amateur ticket, you're making a good living from radio. If your license is taken away, what would you do? This was the day Mr. R had been dreading. Many times he had told us that there was the possibility of getting in trouble with the FCC because of the unusual nature of the radio experiments. Clark then started waving the stars and stripes by saying, "Lyman, your government is doing all it can to enlighten the people in connection with the coming of the flying saucers. But the time is not ripe yet. A vast educational program has been planned, and gradually people will come to realize that all space is inhabited, but now the effect would be disastrous if people were to know the truth. Join the other 15 operators and cooperate with us. We understand your friend Williamson is ready to have a book published called The Saucers Speak, and that it deals with the radio contacts. You know about this, don't you?"
"Yes," said Lyman, "but my name and my city are not mentioned. No one will be able to locate me from the account in the book. My friends have promised to leave me out of it."
"That's all right," said Clark, "but the government doesn't want the radio contact story to be released at this time. You'd better get in contact with Williamson and tell him that the book just can't come out at all, and be firm about it."
Lyman answered, "What can I tell him? I've already given him permission to do the story as long as my identity is withheld. He will think it's strange for me to want to stop the book now that it's ready to be distributed."
"That is your problem, Streeter," said Clark. "But the story just can't come out now." Clark went patriotic again, and added, "Your government will release such information in due time, but more evidence must be accumulated first. Tell your friend that your job is in danger, and your license. Tell him anything, but stop that book. We can't contact him, for we have his source of information, namely you, as radio operator. Besides, if we talk to him, it will only give him proof that the entire affair was authentic. After all, he may still have a few doubts in the back of his mind. Who knows?" Streeter was almost speechless, as he said, "What is expected of me? You must cooperate to the limit with us, but I must warn you that we will not be able to back you up or support your story in any way whatsoever if you ever tell your contact story or mention my being here today, or our conversation." "In other words," said Lyman, "it will be one-sided cooperation?"
"In the interests of national security," said Clark.
"Yes, it will be strictly one-sided." Mr. R had no choice. Although his visitor didn't state it in so many words, it was plain to see that if he didn't cooperate, the FCC regulations would be brought into the picture and he would lose his radio privileges, and, of course, his job with the Santa Fe Railroad. His only answer could have been that which it was: "What is the first step?"
"We want you to increase your power here for transmitting," said Clark.
"How soon can you do this and be ready for some experiments?"
"I can't afford to change my equipment now," said Lyman, "it would be too expensive."
"We will send you the necessary parts, Streeter," Clark said as he rose to go. "But not a word to anyone, and you'd better not give any more information to Williamson." Clark had been sent, not as an official from the FCC, for the government felt that would be too severe a shock for Mr. R and that he might not give out any information at all. So, they had sent a car investigator who was also a ham, knowing full well that there is a comradeship between all radio amateurs, and this was to serve as the tie that binds and so establish communication between Clark and Streeter. Mr. R received his needed equipment within a few weeks and started to experiment at once, but never again did he receive anything from the space intelligences after his decision to cooperate with the powers that be. Later, he was visited by two officials of the FCC itself who told him to increase his efforts at contact. This he did, thereby affecting many of the neighborhood electronic gadgets, so he stopped. He was attempting to beam all messages straight up in a powerful way that would not be needed in ordinary ham procedures in contacting other amateurs throughout the world. Why he was told to increase his power, I do not know, because while science says that high frequency and high wattage is necessary for any kind of interstellar communication,
We know now that a power is not important, but that theotype Wavier used is important. Streeter called me in Prescott and asked me to stop the book. Since he had already agreed to my writing the book, I thought he was only worried over the risk of his possible identification, and since I felt quite sure that Lyman was completely safe in my presentation, the book could still come out without any harm to him. Later I was to learn that he was concerned over something else. I had realized for many weeks that Lyman wasn't acting normally. He avoided us, and while he didn't really seem unfriendly, at the same time he was quite cool, as though he knew something that he couldn't tell us. Later we learned that this was true, due to the fact that he had been visited by Clark, who gave his full name as William, Bill, Clark. We were quite busy with other UFO happenings, however, about this time. Mr. and Mrs. Bailey and my wife and I were on the desert near Desert Center, California, on November 1952, when George Adamski made his memorable contact with a Venusian. Many people have thought that because of our radio contacts we must have arranged that meeting on the desert, but that is not so, for due to Streeter's new commitments, we were not in radio contact at that time. No arrangements were made beforehand by anyone, we simply went out on the desert and what transpired was completely unexpected by all present. Many other things of interest happened during December 1952, January and February 1953. UFO sightings increased and nature went on a rampage. On the 21st of December 1952, Lyman Streeter and five other residents of Arizona observed a large, cigar-shaped object over Winslow. They watched it from 5 p.m. until dark. Two smaller UFOs were seen to enter the larger craft and a few minutes later one left the mothership. All of this was observed through binoculars. On the 3rd of February 1953, my wife and I were coming home from downtown Prescott, Arizona, when we observed two objects, brighter than the planet Venus, which was in a different position in the sky, come within a few feet of the ground. These craft were close enough that the general bell-like outline in the light on top could be easily observed. There was absolutely no sound. I called the U.S. Weather Bureau and was told that there were no planes or balloons in my area. Later the same night I observed another object with an amber light pass very low over my house. On the 15th of February 1953 we decided to visit Streeter in Winslow, although at that time we still did not know about his talk with Clark and we didn't understand his coolness towards us. There were several things we felt needed clearing up in regard to the book, which would shortly be released. We hoped the UFOs would have some ideas or advice for us. We told Lyman that we didn't know whether all the facts should be given to the public or not. He had little to say, for he had already told us that he didn't want the report to come out because of the danger to him and his position. He had the radio receiver turned on for he always kept it that way when he was in the ham shack. He transmitted nothing in connection with our request. In fact, he transmitted nothing at all. Suddenly a radio code signal just seemed to slide in on 405 KC. At first, Streeter couldn't make any sense out of the dot and dash system used. Finally, one word stood out: A Centaurus. This was followed by a very understandable message: okay. This time it's for you to decide. We cannot. The message ended at 12:05 a.m. the 16th of February 1953. The UFO intelligences would not decide for us. We had to do that. So, in this book I haven't given the account exactly as it happened. We thought perhaps it would have been better to omit the telepathic section of our experiences, for after all it is not untruthful to tell only part of a story. After this communication we felt it best to tell the telepathic experiences as well as the subsequent radio contacts. Later, Streeter called me again and told me to stop the presses and prevent the publisher from coming out with the book. I thought this a strange request, for already I had assured him that his identity was hidden. But he said, "I told you I wanted to be protected, and you didn't live up to your promise because now I hear the book is to be released." I told him that I had never agreed to stopping the book, but merely to protect him, and added, "But, Lyman, it will be impossible for anyone to know who you are or where you live." You are completely safe. When he still insisted that I stop the book, by force if need be, I became very suspicious, and started an investigation which led to my discovery of the Clark episode.